Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Happy first day of spring, everybody. The city of Flint recently hired 7 new police officers, but some fear that might not be enough to make a noticeable difference in crime. We explore public safety in one of the nation's most violent cities. Later in the show, new data shows women in the U.S. prefer foreign-made cars to domestics. We'll find out why and talk about what it'll take for the Detroit 3 to win over those women. But first, there are almost 14,000 children in Michigan who've been taken out of their homes by the state because of an abuse or neglect allegation. Those kids rely upon the state to keep them safe and put them in an environment where they have a chance to thrive. But 6 years ago, Michigan was sued over treatment of kids in its care. The state was back in court today to see where things stand. Michigan Radio's Sarah Alvarez reports.
When the advocacy group Children's Rights sued the state over their foster care system, things were pretty bad. A federal judge found too many kids were being abused and neglected in the system that was supposed to keep them safe. Caseworkers had more work than they could handle, and the state wasn't helping kids to find permanent, loving families. Over 30% of kids were withering in the system until they just got too old for foster care. At the time, budget cuts got a lot of the blame. Sarah Bartsotz is the lead attorney on the case for Children's Rights. She says there are a lot of things the state needs to get in order to protect kids.
This lawsuit's about focusing on solid structures, solid policy, right leadership, right resourcing.
Since the lawsuit, a court-appointed monitor says things have gotten better, especially under the Snyder administration. Intake is more streamlined, and more kids are moving out of the system. But the state is still falling short on goals they agreed to in the court's settlement agreement. So kids are still getting hurt in the system. Too many kids are still in unlicensed foster homes. And almost half the kids in their first month of foster care aren't being visited by a caseworker twice to make sure they're safe and okay. More than a quarter of kids in the whole system aren't even being visited once a month by a caseworker. The court will continue to monitor the state's progress for the next few years. For Stateside, I'm Sarah Alvarez.
We go now to Detroit, where newly appointed emergency manager Kevin Orr begins work next Monday. Organizations are already mobilizing to launch legal assaults on that new emergency manager law that kicks in on March 28th. Among the very vocal critics of the law is the Maurice and Jane Sugar Law Center for Economic and Social Justice. John Filo is the legal director at the Sugar Law Center, and he joins us now. John, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Well, John, the position that you hold is that this law, the emergency manager law, is not constitutional. Can you explain the thinking and tell us on what grounds you feel it's unconstitutional?
At its most basic level, we believe that there's a fundamental right in this country that if you're going to have a government, that government has to be representative government, an elected government. What we have under this law is, in the literal words of the law, are that the emergency manager becomes the government, the governing body of that local municipality or school district where one is appointed. Now, it's important to keep in mind that the law doesn't confine their governance to financial matters. Where the problem with this law in our mind is that you're giving full governing powers, not just over finances, but over everything, from where you can put a bar in proximity to a church, which is a pure policy matter. It's not a financial matter. And you're putting that in one person who's unelected and really is unaccountable to the people in any genuine sense.
John Filo, is not the EM accountable to the governor and to the legislature, who are in turn accountable to voters and elected by voters and acting on behalf of the voters?
I'm glad you asked that question, because I've heard that from the new emergency manager in Detroit as well.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, quite frankly, that dog doesn't hunt, as my grandmother used to say. That sort of reasoning would allow the federal government to appoint a governor over Michigan. You know, you have the central government, which is our federal government. Then we have states, and then we have local government. And when we have local government, that is subject to the same sort of restrictions that our state or federal government are under a constitution sort of principle. And like we don't allow voters in Wyoming to choose the governor of Michigan, we should not be allowing the voters of, let's say, Traverse City to pick the mayor of the city of Detroit. It defies logic to say that that's representative in that sense, because the emergency manager's powers are not statewide powers. They're with a specific governmental unit, which is local government.
And I know in January, the Michigan Supreme Court rejected a challenge to the emergency manager law, and they allowed Public Act 72 to stand until the new version takes effect March 28th. So does that not augur poorly for any challenge that you might mount?
No, that was a very different issue. And I mean, we recognize that one of the, you know, the overriding concerns here is what we're doing in Michigan is truly untested throughout the country. This has not been done anywhere else. I've heard people, sort of press people from the state saying, well, we've done, they had to do this in New York or other places where the cities were in trouble at various points in times over the past 40 years. That is simply not true. The model used in New York did not remove any elected officials. It created a financial oversight board that said, if you want state and federal money, you will do this. And the elected officials had to go along. Now, they put a great deal of pressure on them, but they weren't removed from their policy matters. The problem, you know, or not the problem, but one of the issues for the courts is it really is a case of first impression each time it comes through.
I see.
And, you know, we recognize that. What happened in January was a specific component of whether or not, after the people repealed Public Act 4, Public Act 72 springs back to life. That's a very different issue regarding the legality of Public Act, you know, this new law,
okay,
and Public Act 4.
We're speaking with John Filo. He's the legal director of the Sugar Law Center in Detroit, maintaining the position that the emergency manager law is unconstitutional. John, what do you think is the grassroots in the neighborhood view of whether it's worthwhile to mount a constitutional challenge to the EM law? Understandably, the municipal worker unions want to protect their contracts and their members' pay and benefits, so it's their ox being gored, so to speak, by actions taken by an emergency manager. What would you say to the folks who live in the neighborhoods who say, we don't care who does it, just get those streetlights working for us and get police and fire able to quickly answer calls?
I would say that that is a consensus of the people who did not vote to repeal Public Act 4. I've encountered that question from a few people here in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
And universally, those are people who do not live and work in Detroit. The city of Detroit voted 90% to repeal Public Act 4. And they did not vote on repealing it in the abstract sense. They voted to repeal it based on the consent decree that had been imposed on Detroit and the literal threats of imposing emergency manager every 3 or 4 months. Now, that doesn't mean that those 90% don't want to see Detroit fixed.
Right.
I would guarantee you that 90% of that 90% want change, and they want real change. But they want that done in the context of the way it's done in a democratic society. They recognize that tough decisions have to be made. And AFSCME, I would say the people in AFSCME recognize difficult decisions are going to have to be made. But where we've seen in the past with emergency managers, and there is a history, is the sole balancing comes on the public employees and cutting services to citizens. The problems of Detroit are similar to the problems of Wayne County, the problems of Lansing.
Mm.
What you've had is a dramatic decline in revenue in your poorest areas of the state. The property taxes have utterly collapsed. Income tax in a city like Detroit, where you have unemployment that's, you know, among the highest of urban areas in the country, and entrenched long-term unemployment that's not even reflected in your unemployment numbers, and record foreclosures, your revenue has dropped through the floor. So believing that you're just going to be able to solve this problem by strictly cutting services to a city that is already, you know, there aren't non-essential services in Detroit.
the muscle and fat's been cut.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that's not to say there's not inefficiencies. Unquestionably there are, and that's, that exists, and those should be addressed. But a problem isn't because there were truly corrupt or incompetent officials that just decimated the budget. The budget's, you know, $200 million or whatever it is because of that sort of revenue collapse that they've seen in the poorest community that doesn't have a buffer to be able to make it up in other areas.
Would you think bankruptcy, if that happened, would be a preferable option for Detroit to having an emergency manager?
You know, I'm not the financial expert.
Sure.
But if that's what the elected representatives want to do, and they think that that's in the best interest of the city, because it brings all the stakeholders to the table. It forces the unions to the table. It forces the bondholders to the table. It forces your privatized contractors to the table. Then that should be their decision. That should be an option on the table. I find it very ironic that for 2 years we've heard from state officials that bankruptcy is to be abhorred and not to be considered and cannot be done because of the consequences. And within a day of this announcement of the new emergency manager in Detroit, he's saying bankruptcy is an option on the table.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, package bankruptcy. If
that sort of negotiating position is available to the emergency manager, why was it not available to city officials?
And you clearly step back taking a constitutional view of this. And I guess that leads to the question, are you preparing to file a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of the new law?
Well, we've been in consultations with a number of groups and coalitions of groups that are meeting and reviewing and discussing this. I would expect that either ourselves or other groups will be filing within the next week or two.
We've been talking with John Filo, who's the legal director at the Sugar Law Center in Detroit. John, thanks for talking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you very much for having me.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There are 7 new police officers patrolling the streets of Flint these days. They were hired as part of the public safety millage that was approved by Flint voters last November. But can 7 more officers really make a dent in Flint's crime rate, a rate that keeps Flint in the unenviable spot near the top of many of the most violent city lists? Kevin Smith is the president of the Flint Police Officers Association. He joins us from Flint. Kevin, welcome to Stateside. So with the recent hiring of 7 officers, that leaves Flint's police department with 124 officers, and that's down from a high of about 350 in better times. And Kevin, you tell me those 7 new officers really won't make a big difference in crime anytime soon. So what would it take in terms of staffing to make Flint noticeably safer?
You know, I'd say some restructuring and with an additional 30 officers would make a tremendous difference and immediate impact.
Now, there were supposed to be 10 new officers hired because of this millage. What happened?
You know, that's a good question, and I've been very vocal on trying to get that that answer out. And actually, with the 7 new officers, we've lost 3 to retirement, so it's actually a net gain of 4.
And there were supposed to be at least 10. Now, do you expect to be able to hire more officers now that this millage was approved?
Well, originally, I mean, if you just do the quick numbers, entry-level police officers starting at about $32,000 a year. You know, let's say their benefit package is, you know, $18,000, which I'm going to say that's high. And let's say their entry-level is at $50,000. So if you hire 4 guys at $50,000, well, that's $200,000. And if you ask the citizens of the city of Flint to pass the biggest millage in the history of Genesee County for 6 mills, and it's $5.3 million. Well, you're spending 200 of it. What about the other $5.1 million?
And what kind of answer do you get when you put that to your emergency financial manager?
Well, you know, it's funny you say that because I can't really get much rapport with them. But when I asked them that, I think the words they used, it would be irresponsible to get officers to hire a bunch of officers now.
I did see a quote where Ed Kurtz, the emergency financial manager, said, irresponsible to hire a flood of officers only to lay them off a few years later as millage revenue decreases and grants aren't renewed. And I guess there is some concern that even though that millage might generate that $5.3 million this year, what do you think would happen in future years as the population keeps shrinking and property values drop?
Well, it's like anything. I mean, I think that, I mean, it's $5.3 million this year. I'm sure it's going to go under $5 million next year, and my guess would be $4.8 or $4.9 million. But if you have the most violent city in America and you don't really have a plan to stop crime, I mean, people are fleeing the city of Flint at 8.8 people per day. Businesses are leaving because of high water rates and crime. I mean, you're not attracting anything. And in our opinion, we might not have Flint in a few years. I mean, we need assistance and we need help now. They put on a ballot for now. But, I mean, and also note that, you know, this, I think this is one of the first times in history locally anywhere that not only was the millage placed on the ballot and passed in a tough time for citizens of the city of Flint, it was also, I don't know how many people are aware of it, but it was a retroactive back to July 1st of 2012. Folks are just kind of tired of what's going on, and for them to come to the plate and say, hey, look, we're tired of this. We need help. We want to, you know, we're already having a tough time with high water rates and crime. Hey, we're going to reach into our pocket and do something that was amazing that they did. And also, I mean, on our end, we didn't endorse this millage.
Totally from the voters.
Totally from the voters.
So, Kevin, what would your message be to Flint residents as we're talking today? You've got your seven new officers on the street, but what would you want to say to the people of Flint who are listening right now?
You know, I just kind of like say the same thing I say to the 85 officers I represent. Hey, go out there every day. We're going to do the job to the best of our ability. We're going to stick together. We're going to stay as a team. We're going to try and get crime down and get statistics down and not be one of the most violent cities in America and try to make a change and get Flint back to where it used to be. I mean, I know a lot of people are discouraged right now with the passing of the millage and not many officers, and I don't have those answers for them. I continually try to get the answers for them on a daily basis. But we got to all stick together and continue to fight and try and make it the best place that we're at.
Kevin, give us a sense of the challenges on the ground every day that your officers face.
I mean, it's just like this. Here's a challenge. I mean, I can tell you firsthand because, I mean, I'm the first union president that we know of history that, because I've been vocalizing about this millage, has now been placed as a non-full-time position, and I've been ordered to the road. So I can tell you right. I mean, I've been on the road as of, you know, yesterday. It's hard going out there, being down multiple calls. You have to be aware of your surroundings, what backup, where's your backup coming from, what call you're going to. I mean, and that's kind of what this administration has a hard time seeing. They don't really understand what the first responders and the ground troops are dealing with on a daily basis. You know, they don't understand that, hey, if you're going to a major priority one call, that there's 30 people fighting and you only got two or three officers, you know, responding from the city of Flint. You don't know if a county car is going to help you. They don't understand that you need, you know, 10 officers there.
Now, I know we've talked about your attempts to reach out to and get some answers from Ed Kurtz, the emergency financial manager. Have you had conversations with Mayor Walling?
Not so much. Actually, a little bit of Brown and Kurtz. And, you know, even on their end, I was trying to, the new officers that came in were unsure of for about a week if they were going to even have step increases, which they were promised when they were hired. And no one could make the decision. And I climbed all the channels and ended up with Mr. Kurtz and finally spoke with him, at which point he got a little irritated because I asked him a question, was looking for an answer. I was very respectful in front of these four officers that were inquiring about it. And he just said he wasn't going to talk to me about it and hung the phone up on me. So as far as a rapport, I mean, you would think that, you know, we're the biggest union, police union in the city of Flint. We're the front responders, first responders, in the most violent city in America, man. We want to be the liaison. We want to work together. But it just seems like, I mean, and it's crazy to say that, and I'm sure the viewers or the listeners would agree. I mean, how are we not the liaison, and how are they not trying to help us instead of, you know, kind of attack us?
Got to be a tough challenge day in, day out to try to keep the spirit up and knowing how outflanked you are in terms of staffing. And then if you're feeling that you're not getting the support at City Hall, that's just got to be very tough for your officers.
Well, you're hitting it right on the nose. I mean, and you know, we're understaffed, we're undermanned, the crime is up, and yet we took a almost 30% concession forced upon us under the EFM, which every other union, whether they agreed or disagreed in the city of Flint, are hovering between a 20 to 22% concession. So it's almost like a kick in the face to them, I would say. So, I mean, that don't help the situation out, but, hey, you just got to keep fighting, and we took an oath to do the job and go out there every day and work on behalf of the citizens of Flint.
Kevin, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Kevin Smith is the president of the Flint Police Officers Association. He spoke to us from Flint. Here's a question. Is there a gender gap the Detroit 3 car makers have when it comes to selling to women? Data from R.L. Polk finds that no domestic brand made the top 10 list with the highest percentage of female buyers. So We got to wondering, why does it appear many women prefer foreign automakers over domestics? And how are the Detroit Three winning over the hearts and the checkbooks of women? We're joined now by Michelle Krebs, who's an auto analyst with Edmunds.com. Welcome back to Stateside, Michelle.
Thank you for having me.
And we're joined by a woman who has been selling cars since the 1980s. Today, she's the general manager of Gordon Chevrolet in Garden City. And it's a pleasure to welcome Susan Ianni to the studio.
And I am so happy to be here. Thank you.
Well, I want to start with your sense, Michelle, based on the RL Polk statistics. How much of a gender gap do you think really exists between women car buyers and the Detroit Three?
Well, first of all, it's a little hard to know because sometimes the registration data, cars are registered in a man's name in a household. So you have to be a little careful with that. I think there is a gender gap, and I think some of it has to do with perception. That women, a lot of women want to buy what they perceive to be the highest quality, reliable, dependable car they can. And for a long time, the thought was that was a Japanese car. Also, Detroit did not have a lot of cars in those segments that they compete in. You know, they didn't have something that competed against a Toyota Camry or whatever. But that's all shifted.
That is all shifted. And so much of that came from the bailout that was such a big shakeout that it has, or not.
Well, I think even before that, Detroit was very aware that they needed to get in the small car market and do better in the midsize market. Those are two of the biggest segments in the country. And so they've started putting a lot of resources into that and product development. And I think they've done a really good job.
So, Susan, from what you see in the showroom and really tracking the course of your career selling cars, do you support that idea there's a gender gap?
You know, not in what I see. Mm-hmm. Not in the Chevy dealership, not in Detroit. We see, you know, a lot of women making the decisions more than the registration reports show. You know, I think they show 39%. I've always said it's probably 85% make the decision. But you're right. It's registered in the husband's name for whatever reason. And women love the domestic cars. Now, I think in other parts of the country is where the problem really lies, not in Detroit. And I also agree with Michelle that it's perception. Because if you take, for instance, the Malibu, and you put it, you know, side by side, do a comparison to a Camry, the vehicles that it would compete against, hands down, and this isn't a commercial, but hands down, it is a safer car. It has OnStar. It has more airbags. It's nicer. It's styled better. The women love it. But I think what happens in other parts of the country is they're not looking at a domestic car. They're not even putting that on their shopping list. They're going right from the car they're driving, which is probably a foreign car, right back to a foreign car dealership, and they're not giving it a chance. And that's the problem. The other thing I've always said, which I think I told you this yesterday, Cindy, is it's also the dealership experience. Big, big part of, you know, getting women back into the dealerships is to make the experience much more pleasant. I mean, it used to be years ago, you know, when you had the negotiation process, foreign cars, they didn't negotiate on.
And it was
they paid sticker, but they were happy to. They didn't have to go through the negotiation process. People, price is not as important as people think. It's the experience. They want to go in. They want to know they paid the same price as the guy that lives right next door to them. They want good service. They want to know that they can go back and get the vehicle serviced and feel comfortable. So it's really the dealership experience, I think, is more important.
Let's talk about getting the women into the showroom for that experience. Would a separate marketing style for women work? Does that help or hurt? You're kind of making a case.
I personally don't like that because I really don't think when it comes down to it that men and women are that different in what they want in cars. I mean, there may be men who, you know, men have the reputation of being impulsive and wanting performance cars and sports cars. There are women that do too.
So you're talking to one of them.
I don't think that's it. And I don't like the separate marketing campaign. They want a great experience no matter. Yeah. I think there have been studies that show men and women alike like women salespeople. And there aren't
very
many of those.
They like women salespeople because women, you know, fit them with the right vehicle. They're more concerned about needs. What does their customer need? They listen better. I shouldn't say that. I'm going to have men mad at me. But, you know, that's the perception that the customer has. And, you know, you're right. You know, when men or women come into the dealership, they don't want to play a game of negotiation. They want, in a real short period of time, to select a vehicle. They want a price. They want a payment. They want to know what their trade's worth. Just give me the information. Let me make a decision. And don't take 2 hours giving me the information.
That's
and
a huge
that
one.
Is key. And if every dealership would just grasp and embrace that philosophy—
And
it
that,
would be better.
Is that something that the foreign car makers have been doing better in the dealerships, you think?
Well, the reason they did it better is because they didn't have incentives and they didn't have all the different things that you have to put into the car buying, you know, puzzle. Mm-hmm. So when you went into a foreign car dealership years ago, you know, there was no employee discount. There was no loyalty. There wasn't rebates.
They took orders, basically.
Yeah.
Right.
And,
but that's not the game anymore.
And it was, here's the price, and that was it. When you go into domestic car dealerships, you had all these other variables you had to put together, and then you negotiate the price. But now in domestic car dealerships, you know, the price is been brought down. The MSRP and the cost that the dealer pays for the car, there is no room for negotiation anymore. It's gone. So it's a much more comfortable, relaxed atmosphere. You can come in, you can get the price, you can get a payment. It's easier, you know, and it is what people want. But the people that haven't been in a domestic car dealership for years
don't know it.
We need to somehow get that message out and get them back
in. And what's
in.
That
somehow.
I would say, well, yeah. I would say two things. The time is huge. Mm-hmm. People, the process takes way too long, and that's one of the biggest complaints we hear. There's also some thinking of, why do I have to come into the dealership at all? And we're seeing, you know, Lincoln is talking about doing more of a concierge service, sell the car, pick it up for service. So I think those are things, especially in the luxury car realm, that need to happen, and not just for women.
If you're just joining us, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and we're talking about what it takes for the Detroit 3 car makers to really market to women and get more women into the showrooms. We're talking with Michelle Krebs, who's an auto analyst with Edmunds.com, and Susan Ianni, who is the general manager of Gordon Chevrolet in Garden City and has been selling cars since the 80s. So you've really seen the ins and the outs and the ups and downs. Is there a difference between baby boomers and the next generation?
Well, I think we've yet to see that big onslaught of young car buyers. They've been held back by unemployment, big college debt. We're waiting for that to come into the market. And I don't think we know what they want yet. We're seeing a lot of them don't even want to own a car. I mean, what we're seeing are things like Zipcar, where car sharing or living in urban areas where they have mass transportation.
We were actually just talking to Mickey Maynard about that on Stateside, about the fact that there are people saying, you know what, I'm going to live downtown. I don't need a car.
Now, that may change, though. Yeah. They're late in forming households. They're late in, you know, getting married and having children. So that may change with phase of life.
Yeah, we'll see how
I
that Zipcar works when you have to get to the soccer game and dance lessons.
It's funny because, you know, with my two youngest at home. I have a 12-year-old and I have a 20-year-old. And the 20-year-old, you know, they're looking a lot at electric cars. They're looking at, you know, the cool little gadgets, the smaller cars, the funny colors. You know, they like the bright colors, the greens and the pinks. So it's going to be quite interesting to see what they
grow up
into. And
they're not a monolith. I mean, just like baby boomers, the three of us have different tastes, I'm sure, in cars. They are not a monolith. They have a variety of tastes, and nobody's got that all figured out yet.
Yeah. And now, Michelle, you had a real interesting idea that you were sharing with us about some way of letting buyers know how much the car companies that they're considering support women. Talk a little more about
that. Well, you know, there's been a lot of focus, especially with the younger generation, of buying products from companies that share their values, that they invest in environmental causes or whatever. But what I have not seen is, and I notice it being in the industry, which car companies have women in management? Well, I'm sorry, but they aren't the Korean and Japanese or even the European. And I don't think women know. And yet women buy those vehicles in large numbers. Mm. Here we've got General Motors that all the top positions, a number of the top positions are held by women. I think we may well see a woman CEO in charge of General Motors at some day. Ford's been very good about that. But I don't think they get credit for that, and I don't think that's anything they promote. And
They don't publicize it enough. You're
and
right.
I have wondered if that would play with the minds of women.
Well, women support women. That would probably be a good, you know, a good thing for the big three to think about, letting people know how much they support women.
Fun talking with both of you. Thanks so much for coming in and joining us.
Thank you.
Michelle Krebs from Edmunds.com and Susan Ianni of Gordon Chevrolet in Garden City. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. He is, hands down, one of the world's leading creators of documentaries. He has helped modern-day audiences understand and appreciate the Civil War, World War II, the Jazz Age, Prohibition, baseball, the Shakers, America's national parks, and so many more aspects of life in America. Well, now documentarian Ken Burns is returning to Ann Arbor, the town of his boyhood. He'll be presenting his 2012 film, The Central Park Five, at the Ann Arbor Film Festival. And he'll be talking about race and inequality as part of the Penny Stamps Lecture Series. Ken Burns joins us now from his home in Walpole, New Hampshire, where I guess you got about 14 inches of white stuff on the ground, Ken?
Yeah, it looks gorgeous. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you with us. Just give us a refresher to take us back to 1989. This was the widely reported attack on a woman who was jogging in Central Park, and I seem to recall the term wilding hit the news with a huge splash.
That's exactly right. On April 19th, 1989, we learned that there had been a horrific assault and rape of a woman who had been jogging in Central Park, that the police had rounded up five children who were charged with the assault. And they were apparently, according to the cops and the prosecutors, remorseless that they had confessed to this crime, that it was called wilding. It was just fun for them. The jogger was barely clinging to life. She eventually did survive and, in fact, ran the New York City Marathon 6 years later. Much a great, wonderful, happy ending to that aspect of the story. But the real story was that these five were good kids. They had not done it. Their confessions had been coerced. 14-year-old kids, 15-year-old kids, a developmentally challenged 16-year-old kid who faced upwards of 30 hours of intense police interrogation by the finest, most experienced and seasoned veterans that New York had. And they just, it was a kind of circular firing squad. We know you didn't do it, but somebody else is saying you did, and we think they did it. And if you just say you saw them do it, then, you know, we'll let you go home. And after 30 hours of no food, no parents, no lawyers, they all kind of caved.
They caved.
Then they recorded videotapes, which are themselves within their own confessions, filled with contradictions, and between them were filled with contradictions. And then there's not a single forensic evidence that links any of these boys to the crime scene, and it's a very bloody crime scene, and none of the crime scene on them. And there is no DNA match, and so they've got five statements, and they still don't have a missing person, and none of their statements reflected this missing person whose DNA was there. So these kids go to jail. Mm-hmm. Everybody believes confessions, upwards of 13 years, and the actual rapist, who they could have caught 2 days before this on April 17th, but forgot, and who was assaulting women all that following spring and summer and murdered a pregnant woman, was finally caught by civilians. Detectives on both cases handled it. No one thought, maybe we'll just walk the DNA from this character over to this thing.
Right.
They
had
locked it all up and tied it with a bow. And finally, one of the Central Park Five bumped into this rapist who had the sociopathic rapist murderer.
Were they in jail together, Ken?
They just bumped into each other in jail. They kept getting transferred. And so the guy confessed, and he said, look, this guy did time for something I did. And all of a sudden, 13 years later, lo and behold, it's opened up. Within a few months, new prosecutors are assigned by Robert Morgenthau, the district attorney. They decide that they will join with the defense in vacating the convictions, meaning, as Morgenthau said to many people, if we had known, then what we know now, we would have never even prosecuted these kids who were good kids, never been in the system, didn't know about Miranda, didn't know how to lawyer up, and were at the mercy of this. And the only thing was the color of their skin.
The color of their skin.
Brown and black. And that's the story. My daughter, Sarah, who is a co-director, co-writer, and co-producer with me, along with her husband, David McMahon, a filmmaker I've had the great good fortune to work with for the last 15 years. He is also a co-director, a co-producer, and I decided after Sarah wouldn't let this problem go for nearly a decade, it just obsessed her.
She wrote a book about it, didn't she?
She wrote a book about it, and we had the privilege of seeing the first pages of that book come out, and we just went, oh my God, this is a film as well.
Mm.
And it's just taken off like a juggernaut. We went to Cannes Film Festival, and all of a sudden, every festival wanted it. We had a theatrical release. The distributor thought initially it would be in a couple dozen art houses. It's been in over 110 venues. The PBS broadcast is April 16th, and really Ann Arbor, which is so perfect, is going to be one of the last theatrical opportunities for folks to see the film in the country before it's sort of pulled in anticipation of the 10 days later, the or a couple weeks later, the PBS broadcast on April 16th.
Now, I have to ask, and I'm going to look forward to seeing that broadcast so I can see the film, what do these former prosecutors and the detectives who you kind of said they kind of did a circular firing squad around these kids, what's the reason and how do they respond to the way things ultimately played out?
Well, in fact, they don't respond. The five launched a civil suit in 2003, 10 years ago, after their convictions had been vacated against the city, and the city has done everything they could to draw it out. The prosecutors refused to talk to us. We called the police. We called them every 6 months, said, please, you know, do this. They then, last fall, subpoenaed all of our outtakes, claiming that we had no journalistic privilege. This is the most journalistic of any film we've made. There's no narration. There's just simple title cards advancing the story where the material, the archival material and the interviews don't advance it, saying that, you know, they deserved our outtakes and all of our notes because we had produced a one-sided, biased film, when in fact they refused to comment, and we bent over backwards to find within the historical record their comments so that it could be balanced. So the reason why they didn't give us any interviews is they couldn't answer any of the questions that we would have asked them, and they continue to hold on to the fact that they got the right guys, even though there's no DNA evidence, and the real guy went off to murder and rape other people, and that these kids therefore must have run with this guy. This is a sociopath who worked alone. These kids, you know, barely knew each other. Only two of them knew each other. The rest, they were just, you know, kids from the same project area and the edge of Harlem and Spanish Harlem in New York. And they were all good kids. They had no record, no nothing. It's just one of these travesties, and they couldn't admit a mistake. And they were willing to sacrifice five black and brown kids for their mistake.
And of the Central Park Five, they certainly lost their childhood. They were children, really, when you say 15, 16 years old.
Oh.
What of them today?
Well, you know, it's a mixed bag. They're extraordinary human beings who we've had the great privilege of getting to know. You know, in 1989, being a member of the Central Park Five meant among the lowest people ever in humanity. I mean, it was called the crime of the century. It was not just a news story in New York. It was around the world that we had lost control of our cities.
Yeah.
And that it fit into this old narrative that Americans, you know, you thought we'd gotten over at the end of the, you know, 20th century in a progressive northern city, that a white woman and black beasts, you know, this is, you know, birth of a nation, gone with the wind kind of crap.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just being perpetrated as if it was Jim Crow South in the, you know, 1910 or 1890. Really bad, bad, bad lynch mentality. Donald Trump bought full-page ads asking for the restoration of the death penalty. The commentator Patrick Buchanan said that the oldest of them, this is the developmentally challenged Corey Wise, should be taken out into Central Park and hung, and the others flogged. It did eventually, the outcry from this did eventually help persuade legislators to restore the death penalty in New York State, which had been out since the Supreme Court decision in the 70s. So it was a, you know, a dark, dark day for New York, and the kids suffered. They had the guts taken out of their childhood, and they went to prison, and everything you worry about, fantasize, hear about in prison happened. And they've got varying degrees of PTSD, all of them. One of them, we couldn't even film on camera. He had exiled himself to the South, changed his name, works as a forklift operator, keeps his head down, pays his taxes, you know, hugs his kid every night, and still, I'm sure, worries that somewhere some big hand is going to come on his shoulder. And so you just hear his voice, and we have the pictures of him from the time.
Mm.
And the other four are still in New York with varying degrees of success and management of their issues. Corey Wise, the developmentally challenged one, the oldest, who's 40, has the most difficult time because of his disability, and a couple are doing quite well, and we're out with almost all four of them all the time at screenings for schools and at theaters and, you know, various places, and they remind you that if they were once the worst human beings on earth, they're now among the most admirable, with a great forbearance, a lack of bitterness, surprising lack of bitterness, and a sense that they're not going to be defeated by the city's stall tactics, that they're just going to sit there. They need resolution. But you know what? So do those detectives and those prosecutors. So does the city. So do all of us that we could have so easily, the media so easily bought into this story for its sensationalism and not, you know, when they were exonerated, not made that a big story. And there's still people who say they're guilty of sin. And you know, it's a sad, sad day.
I would say the exoneration certainly was way under the media radar.
You know, it was A1, as you know, on all the tabloids, all the newspapers,
yes,
leading the news for weeks and weeks and weeks in New York and even around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And then the vacation of the convictions was page D23.
Isn't that something?
And, you know, a kind of an interesting phenomenon is that it, when you sort of make these informal surveys, you know, 100% of people have heard of the case if they were old enough. 90% are unaware that they were exonerated. Of the 10% that do, most of those think they got off on a technicality. So here you have these innocent kids that, you know, but for the grace of God and the color of their skin, would not be in the predicament they're in, end up in this hell, you know, 13 years of justice denied and then another 10 years of justice delayed, which we know is also justice denied. It appealed to us, you know. It appealed to us because it's so outrageous that it could still be happening in this country.
I'm speaking with documentarian Ken Burns, who will be bringing his 2012 film, The Central Park Five, to the Ann Arbor Film Festival this Saturday. And people are looking forward to that. And you're coming back to where you grew up.
I am coming tomorrow. I'm so excited. It's been a few years since I've been back. I've tried to get back every year, and it's not always possible. And I can't begin to tell you how formative Ann Arbor was for me in so many ways. I'm a filmmaker because I grew up in Ann Arbor. I am, you know, who I am formed there. I love the town. I just, you know, I'm very excited. My parents are buried there, so it's a way to come back and connect.
Why are you a filmmaker and documentarian? You bring such insight and certainly this sense of race and inequality that infuses itself into most every piece that you do.
Yeah, and we don't go looking for race. You know, I think it's just present. If you're interested in a serious study of America and its history, you inevitably bump into race. It's there in our conception when Thomas Jefferson says all men are created equal, but oops, he happens to own other people and he doesn't see the contradiction.
Right, right.
So we're always sort of having to confront it. This is what our country's work is, if you will. So I grew up in Ann Arbor in the civil rights era and watching all of that stuff in the Vietnam era. My mother was very, very mortally sick with cancer the whole time, and she died. And I remember my dad and always let me stay up late. He had a pretty strict curfew, but let me stay up late to watch movies and to go to the Cinema Guild and the campus theater for foreign films. And it was wonderful to sort of not only bond with him, but I watched him cry. When I was 12 years old, in the year after my mom died, I watched him cry and understand I'd never seen him cry before.
Mm.
And that this powerful medium had the ability to protect as well as unlock emotions. That if he hadn't cried at my mom's funeral, he had cried at this. And that was a way that he could express himself. And right then and there, at age 12, I said, I want to be a filmmaker.
In fact, I'd like to find out, Ken, what would you say to those young people who seem to always have a video camera handy and look at your work and say, I want to do that?
I have pretty probably frustrating advice. I mean, the biggest thing is that the proliferation of cameras and the ease in which we can express ourselves with those cameras, that is to say the Internet, is a good thing for the most part, but it doesn't make you a storyteller. And a storyteller involves really rigorous and desperately long hours. So the advice I have is to sort of, you know, be Socratic, you know yourself, that you have something to say and that you know what you want to do, the way you want to express it, and to persevere. There's no other way. I mean, it is not enough to have a camera and a computer. It requires a great deal of work. And while our job is to spend time making the films look effortless so that you can look at them and go, wow, I could do that. When you make a film, it should look seamless, but people, what they don't see, and nor should they see, unless you're contemplating that career or that professional life, is that it may have taken us 7 years of hard work day after day to get a story polished, find the archives to tell it, to use the right music, the right commentary, the right writing, all of the different things that, that go in, the millions and millions of elements. And that's what's not seen.
You had mentioned you're working on Vietnam is upcoming, and I also note on the IMDb you're revisiting Jack Johnson.
Yeah, we are right now. That's a just a pie in the sky idea with HBO to do a dramatic series on my two-part 2005 documentary on the life of the first African American heavyweight champion Jack Johnson. But the pipeline right now is we've just finished a massive series on Theodore Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt. That I think is the best thing we've done. We're, of course, releasing Central Park 5 next month. After that's the Roosevelts. We're doing a film on dyslexic kids who memorize the Gettysburg Address. We're doing a biography of Jackie Robinson, who is a central part of our baseball series but deserves special standalone treatment. The Vietnam thing, which is just about to go into the editing room. And we're researching a big history called a big multi-part series, 14, 15 hours, called I Can't Stop Loving You, A History of Country Music.
Oh, can't wait.
I feel like I have the best job in the country. It educates all my parts, but mainly you get to do deep, deep dives, thanks to public television, without commercial interruption, thanks to public television, and at times reach 30 or 40 million of our fellow citizens with complicated and not just sugar-coated or superficial stories, and, you know, that's a good thing.
Ken Burns will be presenting the Central Park Five at the Ann Arbor Film Festival on Saturday at noon. You can get all the details at aafilmfest.org. And then come April 16th, the film will premiere on PBS. Ken Burns, a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks for making time for us.
It's my pleasure. I can't wait to get back to Ann Arbor.